Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Mark Dunleyton. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with a talk with Food and Water Watch about the effort to stop a new type of fracking in New York using carbon dioxide. Then for our peace bucket, we get an update from the United National Anti-War Coalition. Then for this week's Our Mayo on the Brink, we hear about why young people are still interested in journalism. After that, we speak with Pete Tradish about working in Puerto Rico on solar power. And we end with the Water Justice Lab interviewing Nature Lab's artists in residence, E.P. Fernandez. But first, headlines.
The Times Union reports that a huge poverty reevaluation just before the pandemic has led to the Guilderland School District paying out millions of dollars in tax refunds, forcing the district to take out a 20-year bond to finance the payments. Many businesses sued, arguing that their value had decreased due to the loss of businesses due to the lack of business during COVID. The latest and last successful suit was the Crossgates Mall, which won a $4.75 million refund from the district, as well as refunds from other town of Guilderland and Albany County.
Drug treatment providers want New York officials to declare an addiction state of emergency due to the ongoing overdose epidemic across the state. They contend the state could do more to slow the rate of overdoses that has plagued New York in recent years, killing thousands of residents annually. The Times Union says a key request is to cap the cost of copays for an individual receiving outpatient addiction treatment.
With several religious holidays occurring before the April 1st deadline to adopt a state budget, legislative leaders are hoping for at least a handshake deal in the next few days. Past history, however, shows that such deals often fall apart before the actual budget is adopted. Lawmakers say housing issues remain the biggest barrier to a deal, though education, healthcare, and climate funding are among many issues yet to be resolved.
Albany County is developing a climate transportation resiliency plan for the Broadway Route 32 corridor from Clinton Avenue in Albany to 25th Street in Ward of Elite. The county's recently completed climate resiliency plan identified this corridor as vulnerable to flooding and heat stress.
The last of the Capital Region's Fraunhofer bakery outlets have closed their doors, including locations in Albany and Schenectady, and Colony Center, like Crossgates, has defaulted on its $100 million mortgage.
Unionized workers at Mass MoCA reached a contract agreement with the Contemporary Art Museum in North Ennis, Massachusetts, late Tuesday night, bringing an end to a 20-day strike. The minimum pay for hourly workers will increase to $18 an hour, and salary workers will see at least a 3.5 increase in pay in each of the next 2 years, with some workers being increased as much as 14%.
Joe Lieberman, a longtime Connecticut senator who became the first Jewish American nominated on a major party's presidential ticket as Al Gore's VP candidate, has died at age 82.
That's it for headlines.
For our first segment, Alex Beauchamp of Food and Water Watch talks with Mark about the effort to get New York State to ban the use of carbon dioxide to frack gas.
Back in 2015, the health and environmental problems created by high-volume hydroelectric fracturing for gas led to a statewide ban on fracking with water. However, recently a company known as Southern Tier Solution has proposed to drill in the Southern Tier of the Marcellus Shale of New York using compressed carbon dioxide to extract gas. And so we're joined by Alex Beauchamp, who's with Food and Water Watch. They were one of the main groups that got the initial ban on fracking ban on back on 2015. I understand you're not too happy about this new proposal. Why not?
Yeah, that's right. We're not. So there's this, you know, to us, I think this is just a really cynical attempt to get around New York's ban on fracking. So as you mentioned, this company, Southern Tier Solutions, is proposing to use carbon dioxide in place of water to frack and get the gas that we've, you know, that we've successfully kept in the ground in New York in a way that almost nobody else in the country really has, with small exceptions. So, you know, look, not only is this not any safer than the type of fracking that we banned, but also a big part of the reason we were fighting that fight and why so many New Yorkers were involved was because we have to move off fossil fuels. We have to start leaving some of this stuff in the ground. And of course, in one of the few places where we've successfully done that, the oil and gas industry continues to come back with some new scheme to frack. The good news, though, is that we've successfully now passed a ban, expanded the ban to cover CO2 fracking in both the Assembly and the Senate, and now are urging Governor Hochul to sign it into law. So that is a real sign of progress. But yeah, we were very unhappy at the proposal, and I think the legislature really responded to how mad not only we were at Food and Water Watch, but sort of New York's climate movement at large. And I think that's why we got this done so quickly, at least in the legislature. Although, as I mentioned, we obviously need the governor to sign it into law.
Now, so this proposal is about taking, instead of using water that had other chemicals added to it, using carbon dioxide to frack, to extract the gas. Besides the problem, we don't really want more gas, and, you know, the whole methane emissions. What are some of the problems, if any, related to using carbon dioxide as the, you know, I guess, chemical to drive this type of fracking process?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of them are the same, right? The same health concerns, the same localized air pollution concerns that New York found unacceptable with sort of traditional or whatever you would call high volume hydraulic fracturing. But there are, you know, new concerns if you started using CO2. So to do it, you have to get it in this form called supercritical CO2. You'd need a source of like a huge amount of carbon dioxide from somewhere. Then you would need to get it to the wellhead, which probably almost certainly would involve the construction of a bunch of carbon dioxide pipelines. And in some ways, carbon dioxide pipelines are scarier than natural gas pipelines, because if that stuff leaks, CO2 is heavier than air. It pools in low places and has huge health impacts at pretty low levels. So for instance, there's a town in Mississippi where basically the whole town was sickened when there was a rupture in this CO2 pipeline. And we're really worried about that in general, right? As the country moves more and more and more into carbon capture, which I think is really a false solution for dealing with the climate crisis anyway. But as we do that, you're gonna see a huge pipeline boom. And I think we're going to see more and more accidents involving CO2 pipelines. There haven't been that many of them, in part because we're just not doing this at scale almost anywhere. But as the Biden administration and states begin to pursue more carbon capture projects and begin to frankly throw more money at it, I think that problem with CO2 pipelines will continue to grow. So that is one really big concern that is substantively different, right? If you're getting a bunch of water to go frack, that's obviously less concerning if it spills. Pipeline ruptures from CO2 pipelines are really big concern. And then the other thing is that they're sort of pretending that you frack with CO2 and then the carbon dioxide magically stays underground forever and never comes back up. That's just false, right? I mean, this isn't like an unproven technology. It's a technology that's proven to fail. Everywhere we're doing carbon capture and sequestration around the country, we've found that it hasn't worked so far. So problems happen, that CO2 eventually is going to leak. And then you're dealing with not only the emissions from the gas you've extracted, but also from the carbon dioxide that you were, you know, supposedly sequestering through this gas extraction process. So there's that concern as well.
So you mentioned both that, New York is actually one of the few places that have actually generally banned fracking, but also that, the Biden administration, many governments are really heavily promoting, this idea about carbon capture, which, many people, see as a false climate solution. But, besides this, Southern Tier Solutions trying to do this in the Southern Tier, are we seeing other, carbon dioxide-based fracking proposals now beginning to pop up around the country?
So there's not a lot of this stuff for gas, right? At least in the US. There's some projects in Canada and notably some in China, but there hasn't been a lot of proposals to do this exact thing in the US. And I think it's because it's pretty cheap to do this with water, right? So it economically it probably only really makes sense in somewhere like New York. But what we have seen and what we're really worried about from a carbon capture and sequestration perspective is, listeners might think like, oh, this is kind of crazy that you'd capture the carbon and then use it to extract more fossil fuels. And while we're not doing that for natural gas many places around the country, we are doing it for oil. In fact, most carbon capture and sequestration around the country right now, doesn't go to just like putting it in the ground and then keeping it safe forever. Most of it goes to enhanced oil recovery right now. So it might seem sort of silly to use this sort of so-called climate solution to then extract more fossil fuels, which of course, when we burn, are going to make the climate crisis worse. But actually, almost all of it right now is going towards that. And I think it's just a way to offer a lifeline to the oil and gas industry, a way to allow them to greenwash, and a way increasingly for them to get federal money to do it, which is just moronic as a sort of federal policy. The other problem is that at the federal level, and I think this is why it's so important New York is taking action on CO2 fracking. At the federal level, they're not even really pretending to check to see if this stuff works, to see if it lowers greenhouse gas emission. They're just throwing the money at carbon capture projects. So in that environment, you really need states like New York to step up to the plate and say, look, this kind of thing doesn't make sense here. Because at the federal level, there just is no oversight on this stuff. And I have no confidence at all that the Biden administration is going to make a good faith effort to make sure that we get this right, that they pursue carbon capture in a way that actually lowers emissions. And that's even accepting that you can do it, which I'm not sure that you can, but we know for certain they're not even, I mean, because they're not even pretending, they're not even saying like we have to make sure this works. They're just throwing money at it.
Now, we only have about 90 seconds left. I know you guys have a little hotline. People want to express their opinion about this to the governor, 866-582-4813. That's 866-582-4813. Do we yet, two-part question in the last minute. Do we know yet where the governor stands on signing the CO2, no fracking ban bill? And on the big climate issue, New York, heat in the budget. Any idea where we're at with that in the closing days?
Yeah, on CO2 fracking, we don't know where she's at. I'd be surprised if she doesn't sign it, but the timing might be the question. And so that's why we're urging people to call her and trying to put the pressure on her to sign it quickly. But we have no official word from her one way or the other. On New York heat, I remain optimistic that something will get done. It's hard to know as of this taping what that is, but I think the really exciting thing on New York heat is all three sides have at least pieces of that bill in their budgets. And so I think that's going to force a conversation among the assembly, the Senate, and the governor in a way that just has not happened in previous years. The big push right now is do the whole thing. We need obligation changes in obligation to serve. We need the 100-foot rule, and we need real affordability measures.
Talking to Alice Beecham, Food and Water Watch, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. So, if you want to find out more about this carbon fracking proposal, you can check out the Food and Water Watch website at www.foodandwaterwatch.org. And I think another interesting issue is that after the budget is passed, Basil Sagos, the longtime DEC commissioner, is stepping down. And so the big question is whether the governor will appoint, some of an insider or whether she actually appointed a real climate champion as a DEC commissioner.
And the United National Anti-War Coalition has been busy calling for an end of an assault on Gaza. For our weekly piece segment, Joe Lombardo, the national coordinator from Delmar, talks with Mark Dunley.
For our peace bucket, we're talking with Joe Lombardo, a resident of Bethlehem, but also the coordinator of the National or United National Anti-War Coalition. So, you know, Joe, what are some of the things that, you know, UNAC is focusing upon? I imagine Palestine, Gaza is right at the top of the list.
Yeah, pretty much UNAC organizations around the country have been out in the streets all the time around Palestine. Demonstrations, of course, happening in cities all across the country, including right here in the Capital District. And we've been supporting them, helping to build them, building the coalitions together with people and coming out in the streets. So that right now seems to be the major issue of the anti-war movement. There's genocide going on in Palestine, and our government is supporting it. So we have to be out in the streets and opposing it. There's other things we're doing.
Go ahead.
NATO is coming to celebrate its 75th anniversary in July in Washington, D.C., and we're building protests and a counter summit. We will also be doing protests at both the Democratic and Republican conventions around the issues of war, because both of them are war parties. Many groups that are going to be doing celebrations on May 1st, May Day, which is a workers' holiday, which we always support, but it's also become a day of immigrant protests. And this year, the anti-war movement will be, and UNAC will be working to bring the issue of Palestine also into the May Day actions. And then for UNAC itself, we have next week, April 5th through the 7th in Minneapolis, we'll be having our national convention. We have about 300 people registered and some important speakers and other things that will be going on at that conference.
Now, the first time I personally remember, you know, joining in a, you know, at least a pro-Palestinian protest, you know, was back in 1982. And certainly that was a pretty isolated event, not really having a lot of support. And this time around, it is so different. So many demonstrations, as you mentioned here in the Capital District. And, you know, even those who would identify themselves as supporters of Israel, many of them will say yes, but what they're doing in Gaza and Palestine at the moment is wrong and needs to be stopped. Given that the political sentiment in this country has swung so dramatically on this issue, you know, why are both parties, particularly Democrats, you know, failing to break with just carte blanche, we support whatever Israel does?
Well, there's a lot of money involved in supporting Israel. AIPAC supports a lot of the candidates around the country, but I think really the policies of imperialism are what both the Zionist regime in Israel and the U.S. government, as well as the main European governments, all support. I mean, the European governments were the colonial powers. They went out throughout the world and conquered and did the same kinds of things to other countries that we see the Israeli settler state has done to the Palestinians, or that the U.S. has done to the Native Americans. We were a settler colonial state, and we took over someone else's land and subjugated them. And that's what's going on. That's the policy that built the wealth of Europe and the United States, that and the slave slave trade that they did that built the wealth. And today that wealth is continued through economic means in the World Bank and the IMF and things like this, and they're backed up by the troops. So it's the policies that they all agree on. And the interesting thing is that during this genocide that's going on in Palestine now, more and more people are seeing it right in front of their eyes and saying, there's something wrong here. And when the United States, you know, votes against a ceasefire in the United Nations and continues to supply more and more weapons for the genocide in Israel, they say there's something wrong here. So I think that both have been exposed during this period more than at any other time in history. And that bodes well for building a movement that might be able to turn things around in this country and turn things around in Israel and maybe make a better society where we can have peace and prosperity.
Now, it does seem recently that the Democrats, especially nationally, are finally beginning to feel the pressure from the grassroots and concern about how it will impact in the upcoming elections. We saw Senator Schumer, the lead-in Jewish politician in the United States, come out and said Israel itself may want to replace Netanyahu as its leader. And just recently, the United States, you know, was finally allowed a resolution to pass to Security Council to support a ceasefire. Any optimism that there's a path to peace here? And, you know, does UNEC have a vision? What does peace mean?
Well, I think whatever Schumer has done and whatever Biden has done in differentiating themselves from Netanyahu, they have done because they are under extreme pressure. There has not been a movement like this in this country or around the world in many, many years. You know, I've just come back from Britain where I was, where they've been holding demonstrations every other week in London of about 800,000 people. We've now had two mass demonstrations in the hundreds of thousands in Washington, D.C. in the United States. Millions have come out in Jakarta, in Yemen, in Jordan, in Iran, and other places around the world. Millions and millions have been out in the streets, and I think this is putting extreme pressure. The United States has never been so isolated. Yes, the U.S. was forced in a position to vote for, to not vote against. It has not voted for a ceasefire. The United States of America cannot say it's for a ceasefire, but it abstained in the Security Council. But its ceasefire is a temporary ceasefire. It's one to get the hostages out, not the hostages that are in Israeli jails, thousands of them, many for years, but the hostages that are in Gaza. So they're there to get the hostages out, and then they're fine, probably, with Israel doing whatever it's doing to the Palestinian people. So I think the U.S. has given the appearance of moving while at the same time supplying weapons and money to Israel, increased amounts of money and weapons to Israel, but it's giving an appearance of showing a difference with Netanyahu. The U.S. could stop what Netanyahu is doing, could stop this genocide just like that, by cutting off the weapons and cutting off the aid and demanding on the world stage that he stop this genocide, which we are all seeing in front of our eyes. But the U.S. will never go that far.
So let's do a two-part question. People want more information about UNEC. How do they do that? And April 5th to 7th, what's that going to be?
It's going to be a great conference. You can look up for at unacpeace.org is our website. And we also have a conference website, which is unacconference2014.net, I think it is. And you'll see all the speakers and the different panels that are happening. A lot will focus on Palestine. A lot of the Palestinian groups that have been organizing throughout the country will be there. We'll have the ambassador from Nicaragua will be there. Another ambassador from West Africa will be there. People from, you know, all the different peace organizations, Code Pink, Vets for Peace, and many, many others Green Party Peace Action Committee will be doing the panel. So it's going to be a conference of the whole movement. And it's at a time when it's good to come together, because we haven't been able to come together because of the pandemic in a few years. Face-to-face, we'll be coming together.
Go on, Joe Lombardo, UNAC, and this has been Mark Dunlay for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And so Joe's also active locally with Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace, and they hold a peace vigil every Monday around the year. And at this time of year, it's from 5 to 6 p.m. at the Four Corners. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Mark Dunlay.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WCAALP 107.9 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
If you like what you hear, you can support this program by sharing our content. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
In this week's Armeo on the Brink, Rosemary talks to her producer, Zach Grady, about why young people are still interested in journalism.
This week, our topic is, it's us, it's the media. Why in the heck do people care so much? Why are you even listening to a podcast about journalists and among journalists? I want to discuss that phenomena, which continues to floor me, with my executive producer, Zach Grady. He's a journalist too, although a generation removed from me. So Zach, I got into journalism back in the 70s because I wanted to change the world. It was right after Watergate, and we thought journalists would make the world a better place, full of truth and good intentions.
That hasn't,
how'd we do?
That hasn't changed. I feel like journalism and journalists in this generation are doing the same thing. It's just a different scandal that has been the catalyst to get them into the industry. I mean, whether it was Watergate in the 70s or now it's, voting machines and the future of democracy on the line, basically. I mean, media, unfortunately, has to try and maintain being that objective voice. The problem is now is that journalism is a pay-for-profit industry. I mean,
I hate hearing this. Zach, if I were going out to change the world today, if I were your age, I would have set out to be a lawyer or a politician. They really do change the law and make things happen.
What laws have been passed by our Congress as of recently? What has been done since, 2016 that legitimately could be say has moved us forward?
Well, what has the media done to prove to fellow Americans, much less to the world, that Trump is a danger? He's back in power, perhaps more powerful than he's ever been, and has totally hurt all the institutions that I thought would not be questioned. The Supreme Court, the federal judiciary, the military, they are all in question now because of Donald Trump. And what has the media done to that? Nothing.
The media has done a lot to point that out. The fact is that people just don't listen and don't care. There's 25% of this country. And okay, before I get canceled here, this is from a South Park episode. One in four people in America they used a different word, but we'll go with not all there, doesn't have all of their facilities. But at the end of the day, yes, the stories are out there. He's being sued. He owes $500 million. He's facing however many charges. But guess what? A Trump mugshot t-shirt and mug are some of the hottest sellers on Amazon. So it's not that the media is not doing their job. It's that people just don't care anymore for some reason. And that's because they've been indoctrinated and brainwashed into this belief that fake news is a real thing. And bots and Twitter and social media has taken over the way that people digest their news.
Here's my worry. I always thought, and I think most journalists thought, that all we had to do was get the truth. find out the truth and tell people, and they would see, as we see, what the truth is and what they had to do. And in fact, the more we learn, the more science tells us about how the human brain works, the more we see why that has not been the effect at all. In fact, the more we point out Donald Trump is crooked, that that Ukraine is defending democracy in the world and we need to help, the more we point that out, the more people stick with their own views, which are quite the opposite and very wrong, at least wrong, I think. Fact has gone away. What is truth anymore? Kellyanne Conway was right. We listen to alternative facts.
Well, that is true. I mean, unfortunately, fact is a word that is now debated. You know, what is a fact? And because if you turn on CNN, their facts are different than Fox News. And again, that's because those two channels they're not new. Okay. This is something that everyone needs to learn and needs to understand. When you hit info, whether you have DirecTV or over-the-air cable or whatever system you use, when you hit info on your TV guide and you're watching Tucker Carlson or Anderson Cooper or Rachel Maddow or whatever, those aren't declared news shows. They're not named news shows. Those are opinion shows. You hit info, the guide comes up. Like, if you're on a sitcom show, it says reality. If you're on a sports, it says sports. When you hit info on those shows, they don't say news. They say opinion shows. When you go to your local news, 6, 10, 13, ABC, NBC, whatever, and you hit info at 5, 6, 6:30, those actually say news. Those are news shows. Opinion-based shows, Tucker Carlson, Maddow, Laura Ingraham, those shows are paid for by the sponsors that
in the day of print where I thrived, we had a distinction between editorial pages, which are just opinion, and news, which was objective and had to have verifiable fact. And we understood that. Our readers never did. They never got the distinction and saw it all as one. And I think that's true now. People are not seeing these distinctions that you have. They do not see Hannity as different than Oprah, as different than Anderson Cooper. They're all the same. And we're all spewing what news or commentary that people can accept or not. There is no more Walter Cronkite. Everyone believed him. There's no more Uncle Walter.
No, and part of that is because Uncle Walter handed it down to people that have locks in their dressing rooms and tell facts about where they were in Fallujah or Iraq or whatever Brian Williams wanted to spew to make his better.
Make himself look good, a hero.
But again, when we go to that, you had just mentioned it. I mean, the idea that the general public, as they ingest this information, they don't understand that there's a difference between news and opinions. And we had this conversation a few episodes ago with Drew Sullivan, where it was, who are the top five, who do you think America as the top five investigative journalists? And the first couple names listed were Tucker Carlson and Anderson Cooper. And it's like, no, they're not investigative journalists. They're front men for their company.
Right.
And those companies have stock shares and stockholders and things that they are adherent to when it comes to their price. Again, there's a reason why when Fox News didn't call Joe Biden the president for almost a month after the election, because they knew they would lose viewers. It wasn't about getting the actual facts out. It was making sure that they didn't lose their viewer base by, I don't know, having a transition of power, going from one leader to the next, all of those things that we as Americans try to hold up as democracy.
Right. I spent half of my career working in Eastern Europe and Africa and in Asia and in places that long to have what we did, a free press, a strong, well-supported, well-paid-for free press. And we in America seem to have let that go. We don't value that anymore. I don't think we see the value in it. It makes me wonder what we can do. All the things we're talking about, how do you combat that? How do you make people see? Listen to us. We're telling you. I feel like, who was the Greek fortune teller who could always tell the truth, but no one believed her? Pandora. I feel like that. We've let out all of this and no, I'm wrong. I have to change that. It's Cassandra. I feel like Cassandra, that everything we are telling people in the United States is true or could be true. They should take notice and no one is listening. We are Cassandra.
Well, I mean, we also, as journalists, take ourselves a little way too seriously. And at the end of the day, every time we have a story, we think it's breaking the whole world. And we live in
nobody's listening.
Yeah, I mean, okay. Listen, maybe one of the reasons why no one's listening is because breaking news also doesn't have any meaning anymore. Because anytime that you turn on TV now, there's some red scroll going across the bottom. Breaking news, breaking news, breaking news. Like, breaking news, a sub sank 5 days ago and we don't know where it is or if they're still alive or they're not. We have no actual new information for you, but we're going to make sure we keep up the breaking news scroll and a timer. That was my favorite part. They literally had a timer, like it was the NCAA tournament of air left in the sub. Like, that's not breaking news. Interesting. Yes, it's newsworthy, but we don't need a timer and 24-hour coverage of the Mid-Atlantic Ocean.
And see, from my point of view, my ancient point of view, I see breaking news happening everywhere in the world, unbelievably fast and often. 1:30 in the morning in this very recently, a giant cargo ship blasts into a bridge and brings down the entire bridge in Baltimore. That was sure as hell breaking news and fascinating. And people did pay attention to that, at least for a short while. But then when you get into the really important stuff, what was wrong with that ship? Why wasn't it inspected? It's been in trouble before. Why wasn't that fixed? Why was that bridge so damn brittle? Why did all that happen? When those stories get reported, then people will be, I don't know, listening to baseball games or something. They won't be paying attention.
And that was Rosemary Amaro on the Brink talking about the status of journalism. This is part of a longer broadcast. I assume probably in the longer broadcast, they talk a little bit about the issue of corporate ownership and the ownership concentration of the media. But I thought it was very interesting, and I think it was Political Facts or something, was rating how much false information. And of course, Fox News, a little about 50%, had the highest percentage of false news. But Rachel Maddow was right behind it, almost 50% of the facts that Rachel peddles on her entertainment program were, in fact, false news. So journalism, why you got to listen to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Petri Dish, who has been on our program previously to talk about community radio, is back in the Capital Region for radio maintenance. Pete recently returned from Puerto Rico, where he had been working on establishing solar power in Vieques, and he joins us now to tell us more. Welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thanks so much. It's great to be back.
So for those who don't know who you are, could you explain a little bit about your line of work?
Well, most of the time I'm a radio engineer, and I've helped to work on some of the radio work for the Hudson Mohawk radio network, and I usually work on low power FM radio stations, and I've been an activist involved in helping to create the rules that were associated with these kinds of radio stations.
So your work that you've been doing recently in Vieques wasn't about radio so much, but instead was about solar power. How did that come about?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. Back in the late 80s, when I was going to college, it was when a Gulf War was threatening, the first one, back in the early 90s. And I decided at that time that I wanted to get involved in solar power so that we wouldn't have to spend billions of dollars on wars to take oil away from other countries and bring it here. That didn't work out the way I thought it would. So I got into radio instead because I, you know, saw the way that media ownership and control affected whether this country went to war, so radio was a pretty long detour for me. But in the past 3 or 4 years, I've just been trying to do more work in solar again because I have a project that I'm doing in Alaska with a bunch of with a radio station called KCAW Raven Radio in Sitka, And what they wanted was they have one radio station and seven repeaters in an archipelago of about 300 miles or so. And so it has a lot of area to cover, and it's all on islands. And so the electrical supply is very, very unreliable. And so what they wanted to do was to first of all, fix the radio stations, but second of all, establish them with solar and wind power. And so for the past couple of years, I've just been like studying, trying to catch back up on like all the developments in solar in the past 30 years. And one of the ways I've been doing that has been by spending some time with my friend Lou Yoder in Vieques every year, installing rooftop solar in a big volunteer project that we did. So what happened was after Hurricane Maria, Lou, who grew up in Boston but spent all of his summers with his mom in Puerto Rico, he really wanted to do something when he heard that people in Puerto Rico were going for 6 months and 9 months and a year without power after that hurricane. And I just happened to come across about 600 solar panels for ridiculously cheap because they were being taken off of a corporation's roof and replaced. It had something to do with sort of tax incentives. Like they figured out that they could throw out the old solar panels and buy new ones and get off on their taxes again. So we ended up with all of these solar panels. And so we raised money to ship a container of them to Puerto Rico. And then we got involved in distributing them and then installing them for people that couldn't install them themselves.
Solar panels need maintenance as well. So in part, how is the project? You're bringing solar panels and you're bringing resources. I know there's a fundraising campaign. Is there also part of training the local residents to maintain those solar panels?
Yeah, that's a really big part of it. And also sort of thinking through how to make it so that, you know, they aren't just another thing that's destroyed in a hurricane. So one of the things that we've really emphasized is like how to put them on, how to also take them back off so you could put them inside during a storm. And there are several people there that we've been working with who've been like kind of training up in the electrical part of it. So it's a real fun project for us because, first of all, a lot of people do have like a little bit of solar there. You know, they might just have like one panel or something, or they might have a bigger system, but things in the humid tropics, they tend to break a lot, so they do take a lot of maintenance. The solar panels themselves are actually pretty good, but then once you start attaching them to batteries and attaching them to inverters and charge controllers, and there's a lot of wiring, there's a lot of corrosion. So there is a lot to do to keep them running. And so we've been working with a couple of people there who've taken like a real interest in like learning the electrical part and how to troubleshoot them and maintain them.
You know, my wife used to basically, as a Region 2 EPA administrator, was in charge of Puerto Rico for 7 or 8 years. And she actually was hired by the governor of Virgin Islands to help coordinate the response to Hurricane Maria. One of the huge problems was that the federal rules basically say your federal emergency relief has to be spent to rebuild what was destroyed rather than building new things like solar. And the other problem she encountered was even the place she stayed at, they had solar, but it was going back into the grid. And because the grid was down, they weren't able to use it. Has those problems been remedied?
That's a really big issue for us. I mean, there's starting to be more interest in spending money in solar there, but anything that is just grid tied, in our view, is just sort of a waste of time because, you know, if you're in a city like New York City, the grid doesn't go down very much because everything's buried under the streets. But in a rural place, and particularly in a place like Vieques, everything's on power poles, and as soon as a tree falls down on those power lines, the neighborhood is out. And so we really focused a lot on installing batteries. And and upgrading batteries from lead acid to lithium where we've been able to, because, you know, it's just like a really, that's a really big leap in the technology in the past, like 10 years is that lithium batteries are, they're still not cheap yet, but they're way cheaper than they were. And they've kind of crossed the line where they're cheaper over the full life of the battery than the old lead acid ones were. So, we focus a lot on systems that they can be tied to the grid, but they don't depend on the grid. They can keep their own power and their own batteries.
How did this experience, what did you hear from local people on how the Puerto Rican history of anti-colonial and military resistance tied in with the energy crisis that they're dealing with?
Yeah, this is a lot of sort of what what motivated us. Lou had been to Vieques while they were fighting the Navy. And just to back up, back in around the early 1940s, the U.S. Navy took over the island of Vieques, and they forced everyone to the middle quarter of the island. They took away everybody's land, and then they started using it as a target practice so that the pilots would learn how to drop bombs on things. And so every day for decades, like they just, the island was under bombardment. And it wasn't until about 2003 or so that finally a mass social movement was able to push the Navy off of the island. When the Navy left, rather than giving people back their land, or the descendants of people back their land, because it had already been 40 or 50 years, they turned large part of the island into a wildlife refuge, which sounds good until you realize that that means that they were just trying to avoid having to clean up all the unexploded bombs. And they figured, oh, well, it's okay. If a bird hits the bomb, big deal, you know? So they didn't adequately clean up the island. So a lot of what attracted us to working there was the fact that the people of Vieques have been so screwed over for so long, and we really wanted to do this project. And a lot of the people who benefited from this are actually people who are occupying old Navy land. So it was kind of a squatters movement that took some parts of the island back.
Well, thank you, Petrie. If people want more information, any website they can look at?
Yeah, there's a little bit about it on my website, imarad.io.
Well, thank you very much, Petrie Dish, talking about his work in Vieques on helping them with solar power.
And we close out the show with another story from Water Justice Lab. And this week, the fellows are highlighting last year's artist in residence, Ipi Fernandez.
On July 12th, 2023, Water Justice Lab hosted the art science workshop Forensic River, Community Science and Water Justice with artist Isadora E.P. Fernandez. Nature Lab's first Rubin Family Foundation artist resident, E.P. was in residence for a month, working with Nature Lab researchers and fellows. During her workshop, E.P. connected water testing research happening at Nature Lab with seeking justice for our local water bodies and the beings who inhabit them. Water Justice Lab fellow Muzamil Mote, media mentor Elisha Bacon, Nature Lab researcher Dr. Sarah Cadeau, and Nature Lab coordinator Kathy High worked with E.P. to guide participants in hands-on lab activities exploring microplastics, sewage contamination, and macroinvertebrate life in our urban stream, the Piscawankill. As participants investigated water quality, they created experimental imagery inspired by it and drew on these experiences to render verdicts based on the evidence presented. These verdicts took the form of arguments for water protection, one of which was inscribed on a banner-sized image of contaminated water collected from local waterways. Following the workshop, Muzamil interviewed E.P. about her work, how the workshop impacted participants, and the power of citizen science.
Hello, guys. My name is Muzamil Mote, a Water Justice Youth Fellow, and today we are here with
Isidora Fernandez, but you can call me E.P.
Okay, E.P., I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, okay?
Yeah.
So, Who are you and where are you from?
I am from Chile, but I live and work in Catalonia in Spain, in Barcelona, in a company that's named Science for Change. And we do environmental, health, and social issues. We address them through citizen science and science communication, but quality one.
Thanks. Do you enjoy doing those things?
It's the only thing I can imagine doing, using art to communicate science and make people engage with community science.
Thanks. What are your goals for doing this project?
This project here with Water Justice, my goal was to make people have fun, but at the same time, realizing that they can do something to make the river a better place to have near, to inhabit, in a way.
Thanks.
And also have fun, yeah.
Thanks. Do you see this project becoming a success?
Yeah, because I feared that it was going to be too complicated to explain my idea. And I saw that everybody wrote at the end and the report part, that everybody wrote really cool messages and that we wrote together the verdict at the end. And everybody understood what being an informed witness means.
Thanks. What is your opinions on the stuff we've been doing recently?
It's amazing. It's literally blowing my mind because I've been working in citizen science for 4 years now, and it's very different how you do citizen science in the US than how we do it in Europe. And you have like this commitment, you've been doing it for 4 years, 6 years, 10 years, I don't know, and you're still here. So it's really inspirational. Yeah.
How did you get involved with citizen science?
Well, I didn't knew that I was doing citizen science, but I've been doing it since I'm in college. I did my first project for my, when I studied for ecotourism. That's a career that you don't have here, I think. And I did my first project without any background, without any theory. And I did this project where fishermen map all the places that they loved of their sea in the south of Chile, in La Araucanía, a really important place for us. And I took them into the water, they took me into the water diving, and they showed me all the places they like, and I made them map each one of them in two different regions of Chile, all the places, and we did a collaborative map of the nice places and the important places to preserve. And we did that together, and then I got to study science communication in Spain, and I learned about citizen science, and then I realized that I've been doing it for years. So I met the people from Science for Change, and they hired me, and it's like a love story, actually.
Thanks. And do you enjoy going inside the water when we're at the sites?
Yeah, because I really love hands-on science. I really love outside the lab science. I really love outside the college science. I love the science that you can do in the field with people. Because, as you can see, I studied tourism, so I love traveling around, but traveling with a scientific eye on it, like to put a goggle of science wherever I go.
Thanks. What draws you to this?
It really makes me happy. I don't know what it is, but when I'm in the field with people, I can, like, my goal is to try to make them look at the things as I look at them, what makes me happy when I'm there. And I design all these methodologies for people to see that. And it's really, I'm missing words in English, but it's really fulfilling to when that happens. When I can see you looking in at the water and seeing the macroinvertebrates and you get like those goggly eyes, like, I love that. I've seen you do it.
Thanks. Do you think when you see your peers, do you think they're doing enough productiveness so you can learn from them?
Oof. Yeah, I came here to learn. I didn't know anything about macroinvertebrates or bacteria in the world or microplastic. So I just absorbed knowledge from everything. And that's, I know, I think that's citizen science, to share knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks. One more last question. How can others get involved with this project?
With this? Yeah. You can go to the Sanctuary Media Sanctuary Independent.org and get all the information to get involved with Water Justice Foundation, to get involved with the microplastic projects, and follow it on Instagram, and also listen at the radio, that I don't know the station number, but in the radio you have all the information too. So you can become a citizen science. And how to become a citizen science? You can become a citizen scientist in making up new projects where you can involve people. You can get involved in tons of projects. There is some worldwide, like mine, the one that I started, that's called Odor Collect, where you can map the odor pollution. You can go to the ECSA, it's the European Citizen Science Association, and there's the US one that I don't know the name of, but you can look for it. And there you can find tons and tons and tons of projects you can get involved. There are projects on patrimonial and cultural issues, there are projects on water, there's projects on fauna, flora, bacteria, air, water, whatever you think. There's projects on health. We did one on endometriosis, on women. There's tons of projects you can get involved. Just look for them.
Thanks for participating in this interview.
Thank you.
That was Water Justice Lab Youth Fellow Muzamil Moat talking with artist E.P. Fernandez.
So Izzy Fernandez was our first Rubin Fellow Family Foundation Artist Residence at Nature Lab this summer. This program promotes artists whose work focuses not just on art and science, but also on some aspect of the political moment we are in, acknowledging racial and environmental justice issues. Thanks to Emily Shusas for her editing help.
And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Mark Dunley. I want to thank our engineer tonight, Joan Eason. We also want to thank all our volunteers for today's episode, Rosemary Armeo, Emily Shows, and the Water Justice Fellows, as well as Petri Dish, who, besides helping out with solar in Vieques, is also critical for radio maintenance. And thanks to our listeners, you, for making this all worthwhile.